You're alive.
I'm alive. I'm alive.
I'm speaking with Lucas Smeraldo, who is well known in Tacoma for spoken arts and somewhat a man about town with his positions of projects for youth as well as those that need a helping hand and a stronger voice. And so, Luke, tell us a bit about your experiences in the last few years in projects you've done.
Well, the one that I've been really putting my attention to now for going on 4 years, in fact, March 1st will mark 4 years since I began, was a piece that I generated or thought about when I was at my yoga studio and asked if I could be a writer in residence there. They said yes, and on March 1st, I walked into the studio at about 5 a.m. with the sun just coming up and laid out a mat and thought, what am I going to write about? And decided to put together an intersection between yoga poses, revolutionary thinking, liberation voices, and embodied poetry. So the intent was to put this poetry in the body, and also my intent was maybe from the strategy of a playwright to write different personas that all make statements about what liberation looks like and what centering would look like if we weren't centering around a white male perspective. So I know that I live in my body and live in my experience, but I also wanted to create an invitation eventually for people to hear this poetry and to feel like they were completely included in the whole 1,000, 2,000 year practice of yoga in studios and in throughout the world. So I've been working on that and finished it on October 28th. And now I've, with the help of Caitlin Bowman, wonderful project director, just put together a website that will invite people to support the project and also to see some of the poems online and hear some of the poems and eventually fund a full book called 365 Revolutions. So that's been the primary thing that I've been doing, along with event-based poetry, based on whatever the situation or moment is.
And when you recite the poems, do you do the poses yourself, or do you have someone demonstrate?
That's a really excellent question, and all of that multitasking can be a challenge. So we've had about 4 workshops where we've integrated the poetry with yoga, and my wife, who is a yoga master and has been working in yoga for many years, has helped to create the invitation to yoga poses, and I've done the reading, but I've also invited people that come to these workshops to read pieces that resonate for them. The intent is to put the pose in the body and then to listen to the poem and feel what the voice of that particular persona is saying while in the yoga pose. So hopefully at some point these will be read and be part of yoga practice around the country and beyond, should this book become a resource for folks, not only in yoga, but in any realm or a walk of life.
Well, with that, why don't you give us an example of some poses and the ideas that go with the liberation.
I will. So child's pose, for those that can't see that per se, is a pose that in which you're in a kneeling position. Oftentimes your forehead is to the ground and your arms are extended beyond. And I chose this one. I was thinking about Steve Nabel when I chose this one, because this is about when you're so close to the ground and so close to your shirt sleeves and to the minute details around you, to develop an appreciation for all of the hands that created the things that you're experiencing, whether it's the floor or the seam on your shirt, and thinking about all of the people that are conscripted into work that are exploited. Giving pause and mindfulness to all that. So this piece that I wrote was in that spirit, and it's Child's Pose, and it's the 6th poem of that 7-poem series. I breathe the floorboard grain into morning, my hands flat against the palms of the ones who laid maple at purpose and culled and planted and planed, and no corporate distance can erase the oil from those fingertips, just a whisper below my head. They live under the varnished rings, and I owe something to toil, to perfected locking seams, to craft. And these men and women and underage conscripted are worthy of the center space of my voice at my rise, are listening along the threads of my sleeve, this one exquisite kneeling exhalation, tender and witness, spark and fuel, a breath to carry the story upward, give word to the underlay and the flatwork and stitch, through the cuff and the binding, the tongue and the joist. Give word to the underlay. Give word. Give voice.
Body becoming one with the place and feeling of what is there under the body too. Yeah, very well presented.
Thank you. How
about the one that is the low crescent lunge? The one that has the 600 million bones tired of secrets.
I
find a gesture.
I am a little bit remiss in that I have 28 of the poems here and more on the website, so I don't know if I have that particular
poem. That's quite all right. We can find another.
Yeah.
If you want to find one that's connected with an animal pose, maybe to take it out of the human or to use that as the metaphor for some human emotionality or spiritual state.
Yes, certainly. So I have one that is pigeon. Mm-hmm. And pigeon is a pose where one is still in a kneel with one leg tucked behind the other. And the position is one of awareness and of a high posture. And I imagined when I wrote this particular piece of an indigenous perspective, of being forewarned about the upcoming genocides and efforts to wipe out indigenous folks, but that in today's 21st century consciousness, that perspective can be met with resistance and with victory. So in pose number 6, I wrote, "Sovereign, back body singing and a wallop in my throat. My front knows all sides, and yet I'm unnegotiated. My pose is pre-Pinta, my coast is defended, and I, at last, am the first and the welcoming."
And that is the pose of which bird?
It's pigeon. It's called pigeon. Yes.
Pigeon pose.
Mm-hmm. One-legged pigeon.
Would you like to choose another one?
Sure.
This is Luke Smeraldo reading from his new book of poems related to yoga poses, 365 Revolutions.
You know, oftentimes we normalize or consider to be the images and the expressions and the invitations to practice to be that of people that are considered living in bodies without disability. And what I wanted to do was to convey, and I made an effort to do this throughout the manuscript, to convey perspectives of people that may be considered disabled or differently abled, and to embrace that elegance and that way of moving through the world. So this one is also King Pigeon. It's number 2. And what I wrote was, "This is my royal line. Atypical elegance of the vessel, non-symmetric. A fanfare of different bones on a boosted perch, and these limbs are song. I have trained them by tamp and torque into a vertical horizon of such strange divinity."
Well, you have written poems that require quite a bit of dynamic expression in standing before microphones. I've heard you, and I've heard you almost singing to accompaniment with your poems. But to go along with the poems that you've just read, you wrote in your The Thing That Gathers, a type employs feelings of movement and placement of body. Would you please recite that one? I think it would match very, very nicely, dovetail, so to speak.
I would love to. And this, it was meant to approximate the first sequences of the Tai Chi that I've learned from Kim Ivey. Kim Ivey, the teacher, master, so to speak, at Embrace the Moon, she's been a teaching martial arts for over 30 years. She connects with the lineage of her predecessors and passes that forward. And many of us just love both the kind of Nebraska sensibilities of this woman who's about 4'11" but packs a punch, and the devotion to the practice. So while I wrote this and actually moved with it in a performance piece several years ago at the library, but I wanted to evoke Kim, who has been such an influence for so many people, including myself. Tai Chi. Align your feet. Relax your back. Raise your arms, or better, let your arms be raised. Breathe in several languages. Consider your first move, whether it is your left foot that departs from the right or your right that journeys away, until you have a new base, a base that is different from the first togetherness. Remember that even the peaceful Buddha will sometimes pound the mortar, so prepare for a sequence leading to an emphasis, and stomp as your fist descends into the cup of your hand while your feet remain apart, and ask yourself, am I in a field? Even with this roof and these walls and the windows, am I in a field? Am I in a plane? What is the direction of the sky? Is heaven below me? If I keep going, even below reaches sky, and sky reaches space. So find that, and don't be afraid to try several directions. Years from now, one sect of students will say, the diagonal north was always the best. They will come from that school and believe that every direction should end there. And others will speak of the south, hands pinched like the beak of a crane, and tell you that practice is best under the sun and around bodies of water. And they will travel far from where these two legs began. Let them go. Follow the eastward sect that count each beat, make turns that are full circles, balance ideas at parallel paths, always even to the earth, and breathe in counts of two. Listen to the numbers. The numbers are the book, the Bible, the Torah, the Quran, the astrological charts. Move to the count until your feet say, enough. Make one big circle with your arms and keep changing position. Up becomes down, down to up, circle continues. You are never done here, yet move on to other things. Find a place to gather. Mark it by bringing your feet together, if only for a hard-earned moment. Lower your arms. Join together and lower your arms. Stay here as long as you can. Religion will make you move again. Look at the people around you. See their faces. Anticipate their migrations. Let them go.
Great deal of movement and confusion of the compass, whether it's up, is the sky up, or is the sky below?
Yes. One of the things that I think when we begin thinking in three-dimension and four-dimension is that there is no up or down. That's just an illusion. So whatever direction we point eventually heads towards the stratosphere and beyond. So up is down, down is up. There's no one perspective. And part of the other thing I was trying to get across in this piece is that people become very married to their ways of practice, to their culture or their perspective, and begin to other, there's them and there's us. And that when we develop a deeper appreciation for the different ways that the practices diverge, then we're less inclined to think of ourselves from a tribal standpoint and to think of others as lesser.
Have you been reading these for young people these days, or have you had any occasion to have events where audiences come to experience them?
I've had a couple of modest moments where I've read pieces, not as much in the last couple of years. I've been working on this book, and I think rightfully that some of the wonderful poets that have risen to prominence, including Kelly Richardson and Abby Murray and Ty Nguyen, who have been succeeding poet laureates, have been doing just that, as well as Michael, who I think you had here just recently, who's deeply invested and creating a foundation for youth voice. Really, what a blessing he's been in this community. So they have, I think, been taking that center and performing more. I've performed and presented at a few locations, but not as much as I used to. I've just been devoting a lot of energy to finishing the book and eventually hoping to see that published and distributed widely.
Well, these seem, to me, something of a departure from what I remember of your performances, where there was a social, political angle which you expressed with personalities of historical importance as well as contemporary importance.
Yes.
And you have one or two in the thing that gathers on, as one on Martin Luther King, and I know that you've done performances in a project, The 11 Days in the Life of Dr. King, but that one that begins, Damn Martin, is, I think, one that people could relate to in the time that we're in February.
Yes. Well, so thank you for noticing that. I think there are personas, historical personas that I referenced that were all collected into a performance piece called Voice of the Americas, along with a CD. And I continue to do that from time to time. The pieces that I do in 365 Revolutions, my intent is for them to continue to have a political angle, but to bring, and it's not camouflage, but bring kind of a deep persona voice. There's a poet that I love. I don't think she's with us anymore. Her name is A.I. And she wrote these amazing poems. I think the book is called Sin, including from the perspective of Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, with such brilliance and surprising twists along the way that I've been just riveted by what she did. But this piece that you referenced is about thinking about the legacy that many folks try to create around Dr. King while recognizing that Dr. King's work and where he was heading was much more revolutionary than the way that he's been branded for Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. And there are events that evoke that, including what Dr. Dexter Gordon does with the conversation every year called the prophetic vision. But that in that spirit, I wrote this piece about reflecting on his legacy and what he really meant us to understand and to take into action. It's called Spun to Dream. Damn, Martin. When they turn you into single dream, how they edit you into a single scene. I mean, it was you coming out against Vietnam, right? That was you indicting this nation that sent the poor to war, pointed toward the other poor who were just as confused about what they were killing for, and you didn't want any of them dying, did you, Martin? You're trying to make us think our way away from the head of the barrel. Away. Away. There was a way, there is a way, but damn, Martin, they're trying to tuck you into a solo dream. Screams, Martin, I know you hear them. Wars were not supposed to be fighting. Explosives were not supposed to be lighting. The nation we're supposed to be saving is our own. And you knew that. And you said that. But they spun that into a single word. Dream. Sound sweet, no? Sound soft. Sound bite, single slogan, jingle spoken. Again and again until we repeat the words like a nursery rhyme. Martin, dream. Martin, dream. Martin, dream. Martin, rebellion. Oops, sorry. Martin, dream. Martin, rebellion. Martin, we tell them. Martin, we make them. Martin, we march them right into the middle of Washington, D.C., toward the most powerful uprising in human history, and begin asking the fundamental question, why are the poor so desperately poor in a nation that professes to be so rich? And which laws would have been struck down? How much redistribution would have been enough to stuff the mouth of the man who never stopped evolving, who couldn't stop pushing, who wouldn't shut up? If you could have just shut up. Martin marches. Martin pushes. Martin frightens. Martin, the poor man's king. Let the bullet ring. Let the mourners sing. Let the poor be forgotten. Martin's life rewritten. Martin, dream. Damn, Martin. When did they turn your life into a single dream?
Powerful, yeah.
Thank you.
Great juxtaposition. I remember very well the time when he first spoke against the Vietnam War, which put him in a much more dangerous light.
Riverside Church, I think, is where that Riverside talk, yes.
And his speech on that time made him a much more dangerous figure to the power elite.
I think to that time he was...
when he spoke of civil rights through the Christian metaphors.
I think at that moment... he also broke from Johnson, President Johnson, right, who felt like he had done everything that had been asked of him, and Dr. King was saying, we can't keep sending bodies into this unjust war with brown people killing other brown people. And I think that when you start pushing, really pushing at the core of how violence and power manifests within a colonial nation, that's when you begin really threatening the center of things. And as you say, he became a real threat. But there are folks like Reverend William Barber who have started you know of him. A Poor People's Campaign is marching and organizing. I saw him at the Othering and Belonging Conference in Oakland run by John Powell. And the man is dealing with some significant health issues, but the fire in his belly and his passion for justice is really an extension of where I believe Dr. King would be if he was still with us. So he's carrying on that legacy.
He creates fires.
He does. He does. Yes. Yep. Yep.
Another aspect is you're a playwright. Mm-hmm. And I noticed the one poem on August Wilson, which also brings up social issues.
Sure,
The Fences having been a popular movie of recent times, and some of his plays are still performed quite widely. Mm-hmm. Maybe August Wilson's
The Eye
in the 21st century, where he had a few more years to...
Oh, what a loss for this entire world. I think that those who are familiar with August Wilson know that he is a playwright whose work will be alive and well 1,000 years from now. And for him to write a play that represents every decade of the 20th century and the characters, the memorable characters that he created, is amazing. And so I'm going to thumb through to see if I can find that piece that you're speaking of. There it is. So what I was thinking about when I wrote this piece was the uneven recognition of August Wilson for being a towering writer and consciousness of the 20th century, and how important it is to recognize him at the level of impact that he's had on so many of us, and the opportunities that he's created for so many actors of color and directors, and the stories that he's told. So I wrote this piece in his honor. It is just past August. Rain pounds off the edges of the gutter because my landlord won't fix the spouts. There are floods all over the world, and it is just past August, past summer, past baseball, just beyond the fences. Summer is rained out and rained in, and thousands of voices died just past August. They were put to paper, divided into lines and spaces, but they didn't care. They were living in August. Each one of them was living in August, and no one ever sang a tragedy with so much bass and just right blues. You were the month, August. You were the year, the years, every 10 years, back to August. You were speaking in the voice of every decade, and when the 20th century was over, we got to live 10 times in August. They are not celebrating August in Cambridge, where a self-appointed weatherman declared your prescient winds a segregation of destruction and waste, when really you are witnessing the bones telling their stories after the 400-year storm, after the rising, after the passage, and the catching up. You wrote us into the season of catching up. Weather gets worse after August. Planes come, rains come, wrongs come, hope dies, and we've got this century to reckon with. We got these voices, Troy and Corey, Memphis and Hambone, Harold Loomis and Bynum Walker, and August ain't gonna let us down. August's gonna be a song now. Even though he's come and gone, August ain't gonna let us down. August is out of season now, but August gonna be a song. When a season dies, sometimes it gets to be a song.
Very well read. I like that one, especially for its sweep of time.
Mm.
And it does bring to mind how long he lived.
Yeah.
And wrote.
60 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Way too young.
But he wrote so much.
He did.
In his lifetime.
Amazing.
Not to take things to a level of levity, because there's even depth in
bring levity
in,
on.
In what you have done with the poem that seems at first an ode to Charles Schulz.
Scherzo.
In there with Scherzo, the one that is anthologized in the Tacoma Anthology.
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing if that is in my...
Scherzo Appassionata. It's in there.
Okay.
Yes.
Give me a moment and I will... There it is. Yeah, this is an imagining of what would happen to the Peanuts characters if they grew into maturity and into adulthood. And I think it focuses on Schroeder.
Okay.
If Schroeder were to become a slam artist or a rock concert performer... Schroeder lips the melody before he pounds those keys, making fields of music. He left the bust of Beethoven behind, but kept his pain, searching for blood in the dissonance, cracks in the black ivory, exploding in glory. And Lucy is a memory now. She stalked him into this passion, then disappeared behind the wicked seventh hill, where nickel answers are lost in the tall grass, and his hair is equally wild, twisted like the fray of piano wire. Each verse hurled like symphonies and fat fastballs, and this is the sound of Ludwig broken. These are the knuckles scraped against the high bar, only to plummet like a place kicker with a ball pulled away. Nothing but a falling body. Schroeder is nobody's man anymore. He has tossed his composure and the toy instrument for a meaner upright. The wrong reverb echoes from left field, and the hollow feeling that a smart-ass dog is missing, decried on the canine's empty rooftop by a tiny flying rebel with a mohawk. And kill those keys, pound those notes, crack the legs, turn the classic into keens that pierce the mesh of the speaker while Linus tears his blanket into strips.
You turned those into beat characters too, with a jazz kind of riff to it. Any of the books that you have brought, mm-hmm. is there any particularly that you would like to present that you thought perhaps you would pick out?
Yeah, I was thinking about I certainly try to, in the opportunities I have, convey a political sensibility, but at the risk of taking myself too seriously and resting on that, I think that I like to write from a lot of perspectives, including ones that are that have some humor and some warmth and just home to them. And one of the inspirations of my life is my beautiful wife, who self-admittedly is incredibly organized in some ways and also a little OCD. And so I never need to worry about how neatly the towels are folded in the closet.
Lucky man.
Or the way that the bed is made. I can just see her starting to get a twitch when she sees me make the bed and has to correct it. Or the dishwasher, which I bring chaos to the loading of the dishwasher, and she brings back sanity. So this piece is about all of the beautiful mundane things in our life and the sacredness of that and learning to appreciate care that people take around us. And it's called The Fold. Some speak of roses, but I have discovered the folded towel, not by my own hand, but by the miracle of the woman who sends the first edge towards its center and lays the next atop it, halves this strand twice, and voila, 15 miracles on my narrow closet shelves. Before the month of Lenten resurrections, I saw a refrigerator return from the dead, choking and sputtering, asthmatic engine heaving until she laid hands, pulled the body from its smothering wall, anointed in water, vinegar, and baking soda. Behold, the body did breathe and glow again, a new host for our daily bread. There are saints in small things, in the ways our shoulders are pulled loose from the tight pockets, in the message holy. There are wonders in those salads built in four colors and sometimes six, in apples trimmed toward garnish and carrots and almonds and red lettuce. Do not regard these blessings lightly. Mostly life honors the living in muted praise, meek and powered all the same. Love is a series of acts, not words, like pairs of shoes lined gently on the IKEA rack. So collect your rocks along the river, count the phases of the moon, but expand nature to include our nature, the cumin fingers of the cook, the $4-an-hour hands that brought you the pint of blueberries, the showerhead scrub shined like the grail as warm water burst forth. This is nature, too. This is the best we offer in slick surfaces and single bundles and the Trinity folded within this towel.
You've been listening to the refined verses of Luke Smeraldo on the compassion and poise of the mundane, of dealing with mundane realities, mm-hmm. of tidying the corners and keeping things working with thought and feeling. Thank you for coming, and this is David Gilmore saying, I hope that you've enjoyed listening to poetry on the radio, and Luke Smeraldo was our guest today. Thank you very much. Thank you, Lucas.
Thank you, David. What a pleasure to be here today.